Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Context of White Supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast. Hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Monday, July 31st, 2017. So I have been told. We had the dog escaped for the second time. For folks who know, I'm dog sitting. Second escape, recovered him. The gate was closed both times. He is unruly, as I've said many times before. So literally, the leash will be getting much shorter on how far he is allowed to venture. But thankfully, he has been recovered. Hopefully, we will have no further escapes for the next month. And I'm praying his owners will come to retrieve him quickly. That's it. Context of white supremacy. Our program for today. So excited. I think earlier this month, I was telling folks, I guess I can give you the whole sequence. I told folks about this great new book that came out talking about racism in healthcare, specifically with organ transplants. And I said, we talked about the clip interview on NPR, the book Hundreds of Interlaced Fingers, A Kidney Doctor's Search for the Perfect Match. Lo and behold, about 10 days after I hear the interview about the new book, I go to an independent bookstore in Seattle. She is coming. The author is coming to talk about the book. And I'm like, wow, I cannot believe this. And I told you guys, my sequence of thinking immediately, because I had never been to this bookstore until this month. And I'm there and I'm seeing that she's going to be coming to talk about this book, which deals with racism in the healthcare industry. Very white part of Seattle. This is the northern. It's not a whole lot of white people in Seattle, period, in Washington State. And this is a really white enclave of Seattle. Pardon. So I say, man, I think I'm going to attend. I told folks I had a very full schedule for that day, but I'm going to make time to attend because I could easily see this great book, really important subject matter, happening in an environment where it's not a lot of black people. And then racism really doesn't get discussed. And I attended. Very interesting conversation. I'm so glad that I attended. Even some of our Cal's listeners attended as well. Continuing the dialogue today, in addition to the book that she wrote that we are going to discuss, she has written about this subject matter extensively for years. You can check out some of her earlier writing on the subject matter. Just outstanding material. We're going to talk about some of that today as well. I'm so glad that she can make time out of her busy schedule. She's doing the book tour right now to come and speak with us live today on the Cows. Joining us, our guest, in addition to the book, she is a professor at the University of California, San Francisco, a black mother and a wife, and they'll be celebrating their 12-year anniversary next month. Pretty impressive list of accolades. Joining us live, Dr. Vanessa Grubbs. Dr. Grubbs, are you with us, ma'am?
Yes, hello. I'm here.
Grand. Thank you so much for sharing some of your Monday afternoon with us. Great to have you on the program. For some of our listeners who I'm sure this might be their first time hearing from you, any information you think would be helpful for listeners to know about who you are, the work that you do?
Oh, sure. First, let me say, if I sound very nasally, allergies are killing me today. But so I might be sneezing and sniffling, so you'll have to forgive me for that. But yes, I live in Oakland, California, originally from North Carolina, though. And I am an associate professor of medicine. I practice in nephrology, so I'm a kidney specialist. And I'm an employee of the University of California, San Francisco, but my practice is at the Zuckerberg San Francisco General Hospital. And I've been there as faculty since 2009.
Wow. Full list of accolades. In addition to being a Black mother, wife, writer, lots to cover. You are a Black female, yes?
Yes, last time I checked.
Right on. Just for listeners who haven't seen you, I ask all of our guests.
Okay.
On this program, I ask all of our guests, I use the term racism and the term white supremacy. Uh-huh. I use them as synonyms, and I use the same definition for both terms. The definition I use is as follows. A global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you think such a system exists? Do you think that definition is accurate?
Yeah, I certainly agree that it exists. Global? Yeah, I guess so. I mean, Black folks get messed over around the world. So, yeah, I agree with that.
Right on. Okay. Try to cover as much ground as we can and encourage listeners to call in. Thank you for hanging in. I know you said you're not feeling your best. Encourage listeners to dial in if you have a question. I know some of our listeners were in attendance and got to hear your talk here in Seattle, and other folks have read your work. So take advantage, get a question in if you would like to speak with Dr. Grubbs. When did you get your medical degree from Duke University, Dr. Grubbs?
Oh, goodness. I think it was 97. I'm old. Yeah, so yeah, I finished medical school in 97.
Okay.
And I came out to California then. And so I did my training in Oakland at a county hospital called Highland Hospital as a primary care physician. And so it was once I joined the faculty there that I met my husband. And so some of the background for the book is that I was a primary care doctor, and he was on the board of trustees for the hospital and had been on dialysis for several years at that point. And it was really through him that I got a much closer look at, one, what life is like for somebody living with kidney failure, as well as what the kidney transplant system is like. And those two things together really motivated me, inspired me to want to give him one of my kidneys. And subsequently, we did get married, as you said. And but my solution for him to get around the system issues was to give him one of mine. But for everyone else, I really wanted to try to explore why we have these race disparities in kidney transplants, why it takes Blacks nearly 2 years longer to get a kidney transplant than it does whites, and then try to figure out how we could, undo some of these barriers. And so I went to speak with a nephrologist where I work, and was just looking for a research project, and he suggested to me that I become a nephrologist so that it would really inform my work and change my perspective and really improve how my work was received. And so I took that advice, and I went on to continue my training to become a nephrologist. And I agree, he was completely right in that I definitely saw into the field in a much deeper way than I could have as a primary care doctor, and even as a caregiver and partner of somebody who is living with the illness.
And I heard when you were speaking in Seattle and other times, you said that often people are not familiar with some of the wonderful and important things that their kidneys do for us to make sure that we're able to stay alive. Can you just explain really quickly some of the things that our kidneys do for us and some of the things we can do to maintain their health?
Right. I think there's a lot of basic information in the book just because most people are just unaware of the kidneys, how many we have, where they're located in the body, and all the things that they do. People think it's just, you know, when I see patients in the clinic, they struggle with believing that they have a kidney problem because they say, well, I pee just fine. My kidneys are fine. And I say, well, you know, there's a lot more that goes into just liquid coming out of your body. And the kidneys do so much more than just make pee. So there's a lot of information about the kidneys, just so people can have some basic understanding. And then I get into some of the deeper issues around race and medicine, as well as other things like people coming to terms with their with having kidney disease, and then all the decision making that goes into that, and as well as prevention too. So in this country, diabetes and high blood pressure are the causes of 2/3 of chronic kidney disease that we see. So it, in order to prevent kidney disease, you have to prevent things that can cause the kidney disease, which, you know, given all of our system issues across the board, that makes Black folks, people of color in general, much more prone to developing these other diseases that can lead to kidney disease. And in fact, Black folks progress to end-stage kidney disease, so full kidney failure, almost 4 times as fast as whites, and a lot of that has to do with our disproportionate share of diabetes and high blood pressure and all the things that feed into that, like not having access to good grocery, healthy foods or fresh air, being overexposed to stress, all these types of things.
Absolutely. We've talked about a lot of that content on the program. In your book, Hundreds of Interlaced Fingers, you write specifically, if I can read a little bit, that Robert, your husband, had fair skin and green eyes, which were major affronts to my deep color issues that dated back to childhood. I blame my father and his side of the family for them. Skipping down a little bit, I resented the notion that fair skin was prettier or better. I railed against it, even in myself. When my first cousin teased, "Why do you got blonde hairs on your arms?" I took to lying in the swinging bench in the backyard for a few hot summer days in an attempt to get darker. My baby dolls had to be brown. Only Baby Alive and Holly Hobby got a pass because one popped and the other came with an oven that baked cakes with a light bulb. And as I got older, as rebellious as the nerdy child I always could be, never even considering stunts like sneaking in and out of the house late at night, I resisted in the men I chose. Enter my first husband, almost Black. Robert was the opposite. I would not acknowledge his attractiveness. I thought this was pretty profound, revealing commentary, just speaking to colorism's, I guess, impact on your life. Can you talk about how this kind of influenced you from childhood even to, it sounds like, to today even?
Well, I'm sure we're all aware that the issues that Black folks have are not just with white people. We have a lot of issues among ourselves. And of course, you could argue that a lot of those come from the history of white people too. But as I was growing up, I talk about in the book how, you know, my family is, the complete gamut of colors, but on my, in terms of shades of brown, but on my father's side, most of the family is, dark brown, dark-skinned people. And when we went to a family reunion, I noticed that everybody was complimenting my my older sister, who's quite fair-skinned, but not the dark-skinned one, who I actually thought was the pretty one. And I was, 7, 8, 9 at the time. And I always noticed how my dad, we had to, beg and plead to get to watch the black shows like Good Times, and I don't know if we can even mention it now, but Cosby Show. And you know, it was just clear. And I just grew to despise it at an early age because I just felt like it was just so outside the point. It's like you can't see the beauty because somebody doesn't have fair skin. And yeah, so I think that all went into me not really being able to see Robert when I first met him. I didn't think anything of him. One, I was still married to Chocolate Dude at the time. And then two, I just wasn't thinking much of him. And so in the following year, when I was getting divorced and he called me about just finding out about different colleagues at the hospital that might be able to help him advocate or navigate through the kidney transplant system, that's when I actually, you know, had an opportunity to sit down and talk with them and definitely see past, you know, the color things and see the beautiful person that he is on the inside. And I, you know, had to give him a pass on the light skin.
the color issue, and I appreciate you, you know, talking, because it's difficult. It can be very difficult for a lot of us to talk about those type of intimate things that have been, you know, challenges for us and just things that as we've evolved and look back on our life. But another issue for a lot of black people, particularly black females, I think, is hair. You have natural hair, and from some of the photos I've seen, you have had locks, pretty long locks in your life. Has that been an issue throughout your professional career?
You know, it has definitely been a journey, because I, you know, don't think I'm that different from Southern girls of a certain age, and that as soon as the hair gets kinky, they start straightening it, either with a hot comb, and when you get a little older, with the, just for me, relaxer or whatever. And so it really wasn't until I was in my early 20s that I just really resented feeling like I had to conform to a European standard of beauty to be accepted or be considered beautiful. And that's when I first cut my hair off and did the little teeny weeny afro. And but then I started missing long hair again. And it's sad that I had no idea how to care for my natural hair, which is as it got longer, I didn't know what to do with it. So that's when I decided to lock it. And yes, I did wear my locks for probably like 14, 15 years. And then I just decided to cut those off because, you know, they can get really heavy and hair was thinning in the front. So I said, I'm just going to cut it off. And again, I started missing longer hair. So now I'm basically taking the plunge and watching all the YouTube videos of that kind of thing, trying to figure out how to take care of my own natural hair, which I think is, I mean, I know for a lot of black women, hair is more of an accessory. It's about, you know, you change it up on a day-to-day basis, depending on your mood. It's nothing about, you know, some deep cultural issue. But for me, it is a statement of, you know, I am a black woman, and this is how the hair grows out of my scalp, and therefore this is exactly the way it's supposed to be. And it can be beautiful as well. And I dare anybody to say something different to me about it. So in the workplace, it hasn't been an issue at all. I think I allowed it to be an issue early on in terms of how I thought it would be. But now I'm at a point where, you know, I just really, I don't care what people in the workplace think of it, because I'm just in a very different place myself in terms of my level of confidence and who I am and what I'm about. So.
Right on. Dr. Vanessa Grubbs. Yes, ma'am. Dr. Vanessa Grubbs, author of Hundreds of Interlaced Fingers. You talk about this process of seeing your now husband, Robert, go through, he had kidney failure and going through and not getting optimum care and dealing with his treatment and having to wait a really long time. Did he think that, hey, racism could be involved here? Maybe I would be getting better treatment in this process if I were white. Did he think that?
Oh, yes, definitely. And his background, he was 16 years old when he first learned about having a kidney problem. It was just picked up on a sports physical. They take a urine and they found that he had a lot of protein in his urine. And he had what we think is maybe part genetic, part environment condition that's called FSGS. It stands for focal segmental glomerulosclerosis. And it progressed on to full kidney failure by the time he was 26. And Robert is very much a social activist type of person as well. And I talk about it in the book, but he was part of a four-part short series called Worlds Apart, where the filmmaker was trying to use real stories to make points about how culture and medicine plays out. And his video is one of the most popular of the four. And he definitely talks about his experience and feeling like, one, people made assumptions about what the cause of his kidney failure was, as if to, you know, blame him for it, and therefore you shouldn't get any, a transplant because you'll just mess it up. And then also talking about how where he had dialysis, it just felt like the white people were in and out briefly, while the black folks, particularly black men, were really in it for the long haul. So he definitely perceived issues with the system. And I think going through the process with him, I had a basic understanding. But then once I became a nephrologist, I definitely understood things on a deeper, more nuanced level.
You have published a lot of information over the years on this subject matter. It's in a lot of this info is in the book, Hundreds of Interlaced Fingers. But even from the 2007 report you told us about in Seattle, Good for the Harvest, Bad for the Planting, where you talk about a lot of this detail that you saw witnessing what was happening to Robert, a third of the kidney transplant, black people donate kidneys. People were making that excuse saying, well, black people don't get kidneys or what have you because other black people don't donate. He said that that's not true. Black people do donate to about their proportion. They're just not getting kidneys as fast. They have to wait significantly longer. You also wrote about this in a more recent report. This is from 2014. Even when connected in medical system, navigation is tough. I thought this was important because Robert is married to a very attractive, very well-informed medical doctor. And if it's tough for him, if you can just imagine a regular black person who does not have a hookup with a doctor who can help them kind of figure right. out some of the terminology, like, oh, man, can you speak to some of the things you addressed in this article?
Yeah, well, thank you. Yes. Yes, well, the first article in Health Affairs, that's a health policy journal. I was a primary care doctor at the time, really just talking about how when I was a resident physician in training, how we would often get pressed to convince family to allow us to harvest organs to donate to others, which is completely appropriate. But I never remember anyone talking to us about helping someone get through the transplant system for any organ, let alone just kidneys. And I found this really disturbing, particularly as I went through the process with Robert. And it is true that blacks and whites each make up about a third of the kidney transplant waiting list, waiting for a deceased donor kidney. At the time, and it hasn't changed that much, and that was 2005, blacks got roughly 1 in 5 of the donated kidneys, while whites got every other donated kidney, which means that blacks did end up waiting almost 2 years longer than whites to get a kidney transplant. But then for me, giving Robert my kidney was the way to bypass the system issues. And the piece that I wrote, actually it was from my blog. I I started blogging at my site is called thenephrologist.com. And from there, it got picked up by a local newspaper where basically I was just making the point of how the issues are just so deep. So here we were having an issue with the health insurance company not wanting to fill his medication, the anti-rejection medication. So, and these are medications, if you skip a dose or two, you run the risk of rejecting the organ. So the kidney fails. And there's other published research that shows that, the financial issues get in the way of people being able to afford the medication, stay on them properly, and then have more rejection. And of course, it disproportionately affects people of color. And so it reinforces the stereotype that, Black people aren't going to be able to take care of these scarce organs. And the truth is that each year there are more than 100,000 folks on the wait list every year, but we only do about 17,000-18,000 a year, and only about 5,000 adults are from living donors. So it is a very big issue in terms of deciding who can get these limited resources, but I definitely do see in lots of areas that the system is stacked against Black folks and people of color in general, and particularly poor people. So in terms of how Blacks are donating, one point that I definitely want to make that I'm surprised that people seem to not really be aware of is that you don't have to be the same race to donate to somebody. You know, I tell folks the only race that matters is the human race. I mean, just because you're Black or Asian or white, I mean, it's not like we're different species. You know, we have, we're virtually the same on a DNA level. We just look a little different. So, and the one thing that I was talking about in terms of the, I was in a lecture where the person giving the lecture was talking about how we need to improve donation rates. And basically he was trying to suggest that Black folks weren't doing our share because the majority of living donor kidneys came from white people, but only like 11 or 12% came from Black folks, whereas Blacks make up like 33% of the waiting list. So basically he was saying they need 33%, but they only give 12%. And my question to him was, so what do you think would be an appropriate rate given that Black folks are only 13% of the population in this country? And particularly when you think about the disproportionate disease, not just kidney failure in and of itself within the population, but also you can't donate if you have early signs of disease. So the fact that Black folks donate pretty much proportionately to how well we're represented in this country is pretty amazing, you know, given the excess of disease that we have. So, you know, when I asked this person given the lecture that, you know, he responded as if he never thought of it that way, and just kind of stammered out, well, you only need one, you know, you only need one donor. And I was like, that doesn't answer my question. If you need one, first of all, what difference does the race make? And secondly, how hard is it for a group to donate beyond their representation, particularly when there's so much excess disease?
See there, that sort of thing. That's what the same way. Harriet Washington's Medical Apartheid, top five book, one of my all-time favorites. I'm so glad we were able to read that on the book club. I think I asked Dr. Grubbs about that when she came here to Seattle. When she writes in her book that Black people historically have been overrepresented in organs used for research purposes and all that for many, many years. This is not even a new thing, and tying it directly to the history of racism and exploitation of Black bodies, like, bam, I would, because that's just, that is, in my view, that's white people practicing racism. I would just call that out for what it is. They come out with these bogus statistics and just ways, in my view, of blaming Black people and saying Black people are lazy and shiftless and you just get out and donate more, then we could solve this problem, when that's not what it is at all. in my view, unless I'm
right.
Great.
I completely agree. People try to bend statistics in all kinds of ways, but I'm like, no, this is what is. So, you know, you need to come up with something different.
Amen. I see a lot of hands, so I'm going to try and step aside so our listeners can get a few questions in for Dr. Grubbs as well. We can do one question.
Okay.
If everyone can be tidy, prompt with their questions, that would be great so we can get to as many of the callers as possible. First person dialed in, caller, last four digits, 4243. Did you have a question for Dr. Vanessa Grubbs?
Thank you for taking my call. Hello, everyone. This is Red from Ohio. My quick question was, I know that, like you just said, anybody can donate a kidney to anyone else, but blacks are being blacks are the ones who donate more than what they receive. Is there any way that you've noticed that you can kind of fix that? Because if we are donating, is there any way that maybe we can donate our kidneys to hopefully help other black people rather than them having to wait longer or not get a kidney at all or get an organ at all? Thank you.
So no, actually what the person was arguing was that black folks are receiving more kidneys than they donate because we're a much smaller population overall, but yet we are overrepresented in terms of having kidney failure, and so many of us are in need. I think some of the issues also fall into black folks mostly being type O and a lot type B, not to make too many generalizations. But when you think about blood types, O's can give to anybody, but O type folks can only receive from O. So I can't recall the actual year, but they did make a conscious effort to say that, okay, we have to start reserving O organs for O people, because before they were just going out to other folks because they could receive them. But in terms of how we can do better for our family and friends to prevent them from being a part of this, I think we do have to, step up if we are healthy enough to donate. And, you know, I somebody asked me the other day, I thought it was a very interesting question, and I say interesting kind of with tongue in cheek. She asked me, what did I consider, what was I thinking? Because when I donated to Robert, I had like a 4-year-old son. My son was 4 years old, as if to say that I should have been thinking about saving my kidney should my baby ever need it. And truthfully, I think, my response to that person was basically, I can't, try to predict the future, particularly when I had a healthy child for somebody that I cared about in the here and now, that anything can happen in the day-to-day. And the fact that 20% of dialysis patients die every year, I'm not going to think about something that may or may not happen 20, 30, 40 years from now, when I know that this person right here today stands to not do well if I don't do something. So, and I think sometimes that's what we do. We make excuses like that. Well, I don't know, my child may need, or my parent, or my sibling, sometime down the road. And when the truth is, we just don't want to do it right now. We're afraid. And, that's completely understandable. I certainly had all kinds of butterflies the morning of surgery. But I have always felt that, it's like one of the best decisions I ever made to donate. And if I had a chance to go back in time, I would definitely do it again. So I think the reason why more of us don't is, I'm just talking about folks who are healthy enough, is because that we don't know what people are going through. And I think it's a good thing that kidney failure doesn't touch a huge proportion of the population, but it does affect us a lot. So in terms of what we can do, if you donate when you're alive, then you say where your kidney goes. I think that we should all register with the DMV as organ donors and let our families know that we have so that after we're gone, they'll uphold those wishes and all our healthy parts can go to help improve the lives and quality of life for others. But in terms of, you know, us taking care of us, then yes, I do think that more of us need to be willing to do it if we can.
Appreciate that, Red in Ohio. The person who called in from a blocked number, did you have a question for Dr. Grubbs?
Hello?
Oh, yes, ma'am. We can hear you. Your volume is a little low. If you could speak up, please.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Oh, goodness. Is this better?
Okay. Yes, ma'am. Proceed.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Dr. Grubbs, for joining us. I hope I pronounced your name correctly. I'm sorry. Thank you. Have you, and I don't want to be offensive when I ask this, but have you been, or anyone you know, have they been affected by the gentrification that's taking place in Oakland?
Okay. What makes you ask that question?
I think you said you live in Oakland or you practice in Oakland?
Yeah, I do live in Oakland, and that's a bit off topic, but yeah, I think there's a lot of issues with people taking over traditionally black or brown neighborhoods, and I don't think it's special to Oakland. I certainly see it in San Francisco as well, particularly our like the Silicon Valley folks are they're moving out and, you know, kind of discovering places, you know, kind of a Columbus kind of thing, discovering places where a bunch of people have already lived for decades and then kind of try to take it over. But I myself haven't experienced that. And I think it's because I'm, you know, fortunate enough to be a professional, very educated person. A lot of folks aren't, so.
Okay. Well, thank you, ma'am, and thanks again for appearing on the show. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure.
Appreciate it. Forgot we do have a significant number of Bay Area listeners. I had forgotten all about that. I think this is Thomas in New York. Did you have a question for Dr. Grubbs, Thomas in New York?
Yes. Is there any way that a black person could leave an organ and specify, like in their will or something, that they only want this organ to go to another black person?
You know, I can't say for sure. I don't know. I'm sure it could be brought up at the time in terms of like your family or, but they have to say it at the time. It's not something that can take weeks to get to a legal document being read in front of a judge and all that kind of thing, because decisions about where parts go are that, you know, they want them as close to living as possible. So decisions are made within hours. I don't know how it would be perceived. I don't practice on that end of actually distributing organs, but I don't know. I would be interested to hear if somebody tried it and what was said about it.
I know. Appreciate that, Thomas in New York. Person that dialed in 5771, last four digits 5771. Did you have a question for Dr. Grubbs?
All right. Good evening, Dr. Grubbs, and good evening, Gus. I am a non-white male who donated a kidney to a non-white female who I consider my aunt. Now, I want to ask you your experience in this, because when I researched, you know, donating a kidney, typically, from what I understood, it took 4 to 6 weeks after the battery of tests. Mine took 6 months before they finally told me that I was healthy enough to donate the kidney. And then through the psychological evaluation, it seems like they were trying to talk me out of it instead of trying to determine if I was sane enough to, you know, donate the kidney. Did you have that same experience, Dr.
You know, it's very interesting. Thank you for that question, because I was just in Atlanta the last week, and someone told me that their niece was having the same issue. This is a black woman talking about her black niece. And actually, even though I know that the psychological bit is supposed to be a part of it and trying to make sure that people aren't being coerced or not being paid or something like that. Maybe it was because I was already a physician. Nobody asked me anything. They just, you know, I just walked up and said, this is what I want to do. And, you know, let's get it popping. And I didn't have to go through this, but this woman that I was talking to in Atlanta last week, she said the same thing, that they sent her niece through like a whole day of this psychological testing. And I find it very interesting. And I wonder if that's the experience of everybody in terms of all races having that same experience. And my, of course, my assumption would be no, it's not. And that it's disproportionately affecting, you know, black and brown folks in terms of really trying to uncover some kind of hidden agenda, as if we wouldn't just want to donate just because out of the love in our hearts, just to give that gift, and not because, you know, we're getting something out of it financially. So it hasn't been my personal experience, but it's very interesting how this comes up, and I certainly want to look more into it. And it saddens me a lot to hear these things happening to folks. And but at the same time, I'm happy to hear about it, because it certainly shows me what areas need to be investigated. And I really think it's important for us to ask questions. And I feel like I see it with my patients often, that they'll leave the office, or not just my office, but any office, they leave being very confused or upset and are angry or whatever. And I just absolutely, I hate that to happen, because I feel like, well, if you tell me what's on your mind, then I can respond to it, or I can put your mind at ease, or I can help you understand, I can say it differently or whatever. But if you just walk away, then there's no way that I can address the situation. But in circumstances where we feel like we aren't being treated fairly, or that a person is, you know, cutting us off or not taking their appropriate time with us, I think that's where, and I know it's easier said than done, but I think we have to be more bold as individuals, have family members with us when we go to these appointments, and ask questions. Because if a person can't defend, if a doctor, a health professional can't defend why they're doing something, then that's a problem. And it's nothing better than a question to force somebody to at least pause and think about what their answer is. I was very interested in a couple years ago, my husband and I went to talk to medical students at Stanford, basically talking about our story, and the video that he had done was presented to them. And, you know, these were first year medical students. They hadn't even touched patients yet, but they were just so outraged at, you know, all these issues about race and medicine, and particularly in kidney transplant system. And they wanted to know what they could do. And that was my to them, ask questions. You know, if you see something happening to one patient but not the other, then say, so why are we giving this person this medicine when we did something completely different for that person? And, you know, and you can come at it as the completely, I don't know, I'm innocent in terms of my knowledge of this, so explain that to me. Please explain that to me. And I know a lot of folks can feel intimidated by physicians, but, you know, what I tell my patients on a day-to-day, you know, if I'm saying something and you don't understand, then that's my problem, not yours. It's, you know, it's like, you're not a stupid person. You can understand. I just have to say it right. And my goal is to empower everybody that I come in contact with. And that was the point of the book as well, so that we're not just taking stuff, that we go out there informed and asking questions and demanding what we deserve. I feel like it's part of the doctor's job to explain things to people in a way that they can understand. Otherwise, we've fallen short.
Appreciate that as well. See, the caller dialed in, last four digits, 4443. 4443. Did you have a question for Dr. Grubbs?
Yes, I did. Dr. Grubbs, I was wondering if you could give us a few examples where you experienced sort of like workplace racism and what you did and sort of like your response and things like that.
Okay. The things that I see most often, I am usually the only Black person in the room, and that's a hard place to be, because when there's a bunch of folks nodding their heads when some nonsense is being said, it makes it that much harder to interject, because nobody really has your back. And the most I see it is people making assumptions about race as if it's an objective measure, like a blood test or an EKG. You know, you'll be talking about what we call presenting a case. You'll be talking about what happened with a patient who comes in, and this is what happened, and everybody else is supposed to be figuring out what is wrong. And before you can get the first sentence out of your mouth, somebody is asking, well, what race is the person? As if that's going to tell them something. And everybody wants to drop back to Tay-Sachs and sickle cell disease as their examples of why it's so important for us to know the race of a person. But in truth, I think people are putting way too much on race as if it's not just some, you know, social construct that we made up. It's not this, you know, biologic entity that you can pin down to a piece of DNA, but that's how we behave. And what really irritates me in medicine is for us to act as if we are somehow outside of society, that we are somehow different than everybody else. And I feel like that's where we really mess up, because if, for example, and I talk about it in the book as well, if I say a 25-year-old man, then the person listening to me is automatically thinking about diseases that affect young people, not old people. They're thinking about diseases that affect men, not women. But if I throw in that he's Asian or Black or whatever, then people are automatically picturing whatever they picture when they think of a person like that and everything that goes with it. So, and, you know, for example, if they are making assumptions about what kind of work they do for a living, or what kind of things they're exposed to in terms of like drugs or violence or alcohol or, you know, just whatever. And I certainly believe that we all have some biases about, you know, everything, whether we own it or not, they are there. We create an image in our head. And for doctors, that colors how we approach things. That colors how we think and how we proceed in terms of taking care of folks. And if we're automatically narrowing our thinking based upon whatever we assume Black or Asian or Latino to be, then 9 times out of 10, if not 10 out of 10, we are doing a disservice to patients. So it's that kind of thing that I encounter often, with people trying to put way too much on race as if it's like a blood pressure reading or something like that. And the other things that I've seen is like when I talked about the person giving the lecture trying to suggest that Black folks weren't doing their part. Now, the whole room was like, oh, yes, that's very interesting. And, you know, we agree with that because that makes sense in our minds. And it is extremely difficult for me to, you know, repeatedly be the one like, can we just slow down for a second? And when I have done it, I get shot down. Like, oh, well, of course we need to consider all of the data and all this. I'm like, that's not data. That's not data. So I don't know. It's a tough situation, but all I know to do is just to tackle it day by day and then in the work and the writing that I do.
Appreciate
I hope that
it.
Answered your question.
Oops, I'm going to get. Did that answer your question, sir?
Oh, no, I was just saying thank you.
Oh, okay. Right on. The caller at 8910, 8910. Did you have a question for Dr. Vanessa Grubbs?
Yes, I do. Thank you very much. And I had two quick questions. Dr. Grubbs, I have a similar training issue. I'm a physician with a public health training. And you touched on part of my question just a few moments ago, because as you already pointed out, during medical training, one of the key aspects of the information to gather is the race. And so my first quick question is, do you think that, in fact, there are some fundamental differences genetic between whites compared to non-white people?
No. The quick answer is no. And we have, and it's not just my opinion, you know, something I bring up in the book as well is, you know, the Human Genome Project in 2003, they finished sequencing the entire human DNA. And they found that we are, humans are 99.9% identical, and that the 0.1% difference does not fit into our racial categories. So, you know, some race, you know, categories that we made up because somebody's hair is kinky and somebody's skin is dark has nothing to do with, you know, real, you know, the phenotype, how somebody looks has nothing to do with, you know, the things that would make us different on a, you know, in terms of medicine and what matters. What I do think makes us very different is how people are treated based upon what they look like and what effects that can have on us at a biologic level. But inherently, no, I don't think so.
Thanks for that. I just have a follow-up question. Then one thing in my mind then is, well, what explains the phenotypic differences if they're not genetic between white and non-white people, if it's not genetic?
Well, you know, I don't have any thorough analysis of that other than to, you know, talk about how we come from different parts of the world and what environments that you're exposed to. You know, I'm talking thousands of years back has affected what we look like. You know, if you're in areas where there is, you know, hot sun all the time, then over time, we adapt so that we're not people that as soon as you're exposed to a little sun, you sunburn. You know, I just think there's those types of adaptations that have happened over time. And then because groups of people who are near each other tend to make babies, then those characteristics get passed on. And then when you think about things like sickle cell, those things are, it's more about geography. It's not so much because a person is black, because, you know, those things grew out of humanity adapting to the fact that, okay, there's this malaria that's killing folks, so we need to adapt so that we're not all dying out. And the people who have the adaptation, they are protected, but if they get with somebody else who has the adaptation, then there's sickle cell disease. So that's not so much about that it's a black person. It's about people living in sub-Saharan Africa where the people there happen to be black, but that's also because that's where the mosquitoes that are passing malaria around are. And folks always forget these things in terms of like sickle cell too. It's not just sub-Saharan Africa. It's also places like the Mediterranean. But because those folks aren't black, nobody's thinking about things when it comes to those folks. So it's not about the race. It was about the geography and just how we have that adaptations over time. So I don't know. I know a lot of people, they try to put a whole lot on different genes. And I won't deny that genes have, of course, things are hereditary and things are passed on genetically. But the reason why I argue so strongly against putting the emphasis on it is because in this country in particular, I feel like the moment that we say that something is genetic is the exact same moment that in medicine we throw up our hands and decide not to do anything about all the various social determinants of health that are really killing us, like the fact that we don't have access disproportionately to clean air, to healthy food, to safe neighborhoods. So if somebody says, oh, well, it's a gene, then we can't do anything about that, then that's ridiculous. And so that's how I feel about it, and I will, you know, continue to jump up and down about it.
Dr. Vanessa Grubbs, author of hundreds of Interlaced Fingers, A Kidney Doctor's Search for the Perfect Match. You can also visit her website and blog, thenephrologist.com. I'm linking it on our Facebook page and tweet it out as well. Also, wanted to make sure I got in a question. I don't think I missed any of our callers. I don't think. If you have a hand up, you should go ahead and raise it now and make sure I don't miss your question. Also wanted to make sure I ask, Dr. Grubbs, what do you mean when you use the term militant?
Because that's what I called you. Well, before I answer that, I just want to let folks know who are any of your listeners who are in the Chicago area that I will be doing a signing, reading a signing at the bookseller in Chicago. It's on Lincoln Avenue. So I'll be there on Thursday at 7 p.m. And so if anybody is in that area and want to come through, then I welcome meeting them. But in terms of militant, so you're referring to when you were at my Seattle reading, and as you said, I think you were one of two Black folks there, and you repeatedly asked the race and racism questions, and my sense was that I didn't answer them hardcore enough for you. So that's when I said, well, you know, why don't you come and talk to me after? And then I was just joking with you, like, okay, here comes my militant brother. You know, come on, let's talk about it. So that's all I meant by it. No harm.
What's your response? Frequently, that term is used in a pejorative manner to invalidate a Black person's critique of white supremacy racism.
No, I don't. I don't think about it that way. But I just feel like it's kind of sometimes it can get in the way of us getting anything done. And I'm still kind of on both sides of it, because on the one hand, I am tired of the majority acting as if we need to tiptoe around their feelings all the time. And because, you know, they can't deal with it. But when we do come out hard at them, they spend all their time trying to distance themselves from the thing. You know, they spend all their time pointing out how they're not a racist, how even some of their best friends are Black or whatever. And we never get anywhere when people can never see themselves as part of the issue or even admit that they are a benefit from the current system. So I just think in that sense, it puts people in a defensive mode, and therefore we're not able to really move forward. And on the other side of it, you know, there's folks that have made their whole career in medicine just pointing out that there are race disparities. And, you know, in my mind, you know, I'm like, okay, and now what? You know, we can't just keep pointing out that stuff is not fair. At some point, we need to figure out, and so what are we going to do about it? And, you know, I personally don't like to hear people just pointing out the obvious, and they don't come with any solution.
Valid point. But my last militant question, can you think of any white people who are labeled as militant?
can you be militant when you run things? Is that the way it goes?
I mean, it depends on what you mean by... It would depend on what you mean
with
the word militant. But
I hear your point. It's something that, Black Power, Black Panthers and all of that to, you know, try to put like it's a bad thing on it. And I hear that, and I think that's a very valid point. In my mind, though, it's more, when I said it to you, it was kind of like, you know, come on, brother, let's talk about this stuff. Let's talk about it on a deeper level.
I
didn't mean any harm.
None taken. Just I have been called militant enough in my life that now I ask people, what do you mean?
And I've been an angry Black woman many times in my life instead of passionate or concerned. So, you know, it goes around to all of us.
I feel you.
Not that it makes it right.
Absolutely. As a doctor, though, we have been paying a lot of attention to the updates about the CRISPR technology. I know this is not exactly your field as a nephrologist, but I don't know if you've been paying attention to this. Do you have any concerns with where this could be going in terms of making, really specific alterations to genetics and DNA and the ramifications of this?
All of this stuff, really, it bothers me in that we not so much of playing God, but acting as if we don't have to die at some point. You know, I feel like folks keep doing this stuff to replace our parts that die off so we can live forever. But we're not supposed to live forever. We're supposed to die and make room for new people, new ideas. And, you know, it all bothers me because that nobody thinks about the ethics of it. And that's why we're in the shape that we're in right now with dialysis. It started out to be something that for people with a problem to the kidney failure, usually mostly temporary. There are some cases that are temporary to support them so they can get past it and get back to, you know, taking care of their families. So it was supposed to be like rehabilitation to help people get back to what they can, what they could do to contribute to whatever. But now we've gotten to this point where if kidney failure, then dialysis. And so we've got 90-year-old folks with severe dementia on dialysis because we say we want to prolong survival, but we're not doing anybody any favors. And so my point is that we're not thinking about the big picture consequences of what we're doing to people, that we can't just be about, you know, preserving, life at a technical level, like a beating heart. We have to be thinking more about what is the quality of that life. And we can't approach life as if death is optional. And I feel like that's especially what we do in this country, because we do have, even though it's disproportionately distributed, we just have a ridiculous amount of wealth and excess compared to other parts of the world.
Again, Dr. Vanessa Grubbs, I did want to make sure I asked, just with the use of the term we, this is something I bring up on the program regularly, because I think it's very important, critically important, when we discuss these issues, to try to do so in a manner that's as accurate as possible. With regards to the racial classifications, you were saying that we made these classifications based on hair texture or skin color, and then we all have biases in the way that we perceive people, and that can impact the way that we conduct ourselves. If we're a medical practitioner or whatever your field of study is, everybody has biases. And that, to me, I do not equate everyone's quote-unquote biases with racism, white supremacy. When I discuss racism,
white
supremacy.
Oh, of course. I completely agree.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, we can all think something about whomever based on where we came from. But to me, racism and to be racist is somebody who is in a position of power to exert that over someone else.
Mm.
Now, just because I might think something of, you know, this person or that, I mean, in my medical profession, I need to check that and deal with the person in front of me, but I'm not changing where they get to live or if they get to vote. I mean, so that's very different. So I do agree. I acknowledge that I'm using we in different contexts. Sometimes I'm using we as medical providers because I certainly don't consider myself as, you know, outside of, I'm all about, I'm not just going to point fingers at folks. I feel like I'm part of this too. And then when I'm talking about we, as in people of color, I'm talking about, you know, just that. And sometimes I'm talking about we as just Black folks. And oftentimes I will include other people of color because even though most of the data that we have is just focused on Black and white, there's you know, nobody can deny that there's lots of issues for other groups as well, and particularly like Native Americans, you know. So, yeah, point taken, and that's what I mean when I'm saying we.
Understood. I tweeted your events, so people, we do have listeners in the Chicago area as well. They can go and check Dr. Grubbs out when she comes to visit Chicago later in the week. And then you can check out her calendar out. It's got, I think, the rest of the year up for different events. We have listeners in California as well. She has events coming up there later in the year. Dr. Vanessa Grubbs, the book again, Hundreds of Interlaced Fingers. She has lots of outstanding research on racism, healthcare. Check out her material, and congratulations to you and husband Robert. 12 years married next month. Congratulations. Outstanding accomplishment.
Thank you.
And wishing you all many, many more years.
Thank you. Appreciate that. And thank you so much for having me on your show and opportunity to talk about all these various issues with more folks.
Absolutely. Best wishes with the book. I hope it sells tons of copies, and safe travels to Chicago later in the week. Hope the book tour continues to go great.
Okay. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Take care, Dr. Grubbs.
Bye-bye.
Good evening. Context of White Supremacy. Dr. Vanessa Grubbs had her on the program. Grant, this is, I think, one of the few times I can say I met the guest in person beforehand, heard them talk about their book and what have you. I'd heard them do interviews and such, and then had them on the broadcast. That is, I think, maybe a first in the history of the Context of White Supremacy, but glad we could have her on the broadcast. And if we have any listeners in the Chicago area, go check it and ask questions. You can say, hey, I heard you on the Cows this week. Can you talk about, you know, whatever point that you'd like her to bring up? But she's in the Chicago area. If you have time this week, go check her out. And I did post her events page on my Twitter just a few moments ago, so you can check that out and see where she's going to be. As I said, we have listeners in the California area. You can see where she's going to be at. If she's going to be close, she's even going to be in Georgia. Or she was, yeah, she was, oh man, you just missed it. She was just in Georgia a few days ago. You could have caught her in Georgia as well. I know we have listeners down there also. Anywho, we'll take a quick commercial break. In fact, the way I'll take our commercial, just for the seriousness of this topic, because we talked about this before with medical apartheid when I wrote my article about Dr. Grubbs' book and her visit to Seattle and covering a lot of the information that we talked about today, it reminded me of how many programs we have covered on this subject matter over the years. We had our book study session on Harriet A. Washington's Medical Apartheid, one of my favorite books all time, bar none. We had Rebecca Skloot, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, not one of my favorites, but we did do that on the book club, and that is an important book. We talked about this, Killing the Black Body, Dorothy Roberts, very important book. I think that's in my top 10. Renelia Randall, she gave out the exact same suggestion when she was on the program in the summer of 2009 about if you have to go to the hospital or to go see a doctor, take someone with you who is healthy so that they can ask questions. You don't have to have a medical degree. Just being able to ask questions can be a huge advantage to you if you have to go to the doctor, and of course, doing preventive care. But we've covered this stuff subject extensively. Even Dr. John Hoberman, he was on the program twice, but specifically we had him on to talk about Black and Blue, one of his more recent books, and he talked about the history of medical racism. That was in 2012 when we had him on the program, extensively covered this field of study on the Cows with regards to medical racism. But I'm going to play a clip. This is from Hidden Colors, The Rules of Racism. This deals specifically with today's subject matter, with organ transplants, racism, and the long history of abusing Black people in this area. Quick sound clip, and then we'll get any feedback, commentary from our listeners. If folks have a question or comments that they want to share, a quick sound clip. Again, this is from Tariq Nasheed's Hidden Colors, The Rules of Racism. And I think you'll hear even some of our CALS guests in this clip, Dr. Shahrazad Ali, Dr. Umar Abdullah Johnson, Tariq Nasheed himself, and a few other folks. Dick Gregory, I think he's the first voice that you'll hear. But context of white supremacy, quick sound clip, and then we'll be right back.
You, my son. Cops come by and inform me you've just been shot dead. You don't have jurisdiction over that body. That's the coroner. You can't get that body to the coroner. Release you. So we'll get released. We go down and pick it up. And I see all these cuts and these stitches. I just thought they was doing a retuned investigation following the fact they only took your organs. I'm under all this stress. My son is dead. Now, you buried now. I can't dig you up because the court got to have permission. Most of those cases is organ stealing.
It's been known for a long time, even back in slavery times, that black organs were considered superior genetically to other folks' organs. For example, whenever there's a transplant, okay, especially when rich folks get heart transplant, liver transplant, kidney transplant, they like white, they like black organs. We had a famous case in Pennsylvania, Governor Casey, who was one of the most racist governors who ever lived, back in the late 80s, early 90s. He had a heart transplant. Guess whose heart they gave him? A black person's heart.
Down in Georgia, there was a case of an African-American 17-year-old kid who was found mysteriously dead at school. He died in the gym. They did an autopsy and they buried him. His family, they weren't satisfied with the results because they still wanted to know what happened to their son. They had the body exhumed, found out that his organs were missing and his body was stuffed with newspapers, and people are still trying to find answers. The officials down there in Georgia, they act like they don't know what's going on. There was another case out here in California. A young African-American man was found dead in Death Valley in the desert. All of his organs were missing. His liver, heart, lungs, kidneys, all gone. There's a case in the UK recently. A Somalian girl was brought over there for organ harvesting. They found out that they were going to harvest her organs, and they stopped that. There was another case in Asian couples. They went over to Africa. They adopted a black girl. 2 weeks later, she was dead. So these cases of organ harvesting are just going on all over the world, and people are being real quiet about it.
The Rodney King riots. The cops arrested 18,213 black folks. They couldn't account for 10,000 of them.
That's what happened in New Orleans. Remember when you saw those helicopters? They were picking up all them black babies and taking them up in the helicopter. And my husband and I sit down and said, we wouldn't have sent our son with them. I don't care who they was. We'd all died in the water together. We wouldn't have sent our baby up there. And they never got a bunch of those children back, as we all know.
Organ harvesting in Africa, it's a business. In fact, they've set up so many sophisticated places around the so-called third world where there are nations like France, England, New Zealand, Israel. All these places now are looking in the impoverished areas because mostly in these impoverished areas like Brazil, places in South Africa, right here on this continent, wherever there's poverty, there's crime. And wherever there's crime, you know there's a lot of deaths and there's a lot of shooting.
They are killing black people for their organs. Think about it. Organs are the only commodity that people must have to live that you cannot buy in a store. So if I am sick and I need a heart, I can't buy that. And we know all the problems with the fake hearts, that it can give a pacemaker to a bad heart. But what about when the heart needs to be replaced? You got to find a match, and it ain't none on the donor list, and I'm worth $50 million, and I could care less about black people anyway. Guess what? Somebody gonna get shot in a drive-by.
Switch over to Haiti. Jean Bellerive, at the time, he was the prime minister at the time when Katie was hit with that earthquake that killed over 130,000 brothers and sisters down there in that island. They had a report on CNN with Jean Bellerive, and he said specifically that there was organ harvesting and child kidnapping going on.
And we have already reports of a lot of trafficking, even of organ trafficking.
Of organ trafficking?
Yeah.
Now?
Now, already.
Of the victims of the earthquake?
Yeah.
So, do you know that for sure?
Yeah, I know that for sure, and it was discussed in Montreal during the conference.
Context of white supremacy. We'll be here At minimum, we'll be here on Thursday, Workplace Racism, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, and Friday. Feels like it'll be session number one, but it's actually our second study session on France Fanon, The Wretched of the Earth. We are all done with the preface. Now we will get down to what Fanon had to say. That's Friday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. You can always visit Black Talk Radio Network and the Facebook page to get updates on when we will be broadcasting. Sometimes things pop up spontaneously, so stay tuned. But at minimum, we will be here this coming Thursday. And I did post Dr. Vanessa Grubb's event schedule. I just tweeted it, and I posted on Facebook her blog, The Nephrologist. You can check that out also, and it's got her little events tab at the top, so you can go to her website and you can see her upcoming dates. For people in Chicago, I would go check it out. If she was going to be in the area, go check it out. It's a great way to practice asking questions. If you listen to the broadcast and heard her, or if you get her book and check it out, you can go and ask specific questions about racism, or if you had other questions you didn't get a chance to ask, or thought of questions just hearing her, go ask questions. In my view, I think it always is constructive when they're having these types of discussions, and you can go and ask questions about racism, white supremacy. It can have a huge impact because it can motivate other non-white people who are present to also ask a question. Sometimes we can just be intimidated. Racism is terrorism. A lot of black people, a lot of non-white people, period, have been frightened from talking about or speaking publicly about racism. So just seeing one person do it can make, hey, if they did it, I can do it too. And I've seen that happen a lot. So go ask questions. It can be very constructive, and you never know, you might meet some other non-white people present where, hey, now you have two people, three people that can work together in a constructive manner with regards to white supremacy, racism. With that, glad we could have Dr. Grubbs on the program. Was glad that I asked her about the term militant, which I make an effort to do anytime that I'm called militant, or any other terms that I'm curious about. Just what do you mean when you use that term? And I would stick by what I said, because generally I don't hear white people described as militant. Depends on what you mean when you say militant. In my view, nobody is more militant than racist man, racist woman, and racist child. You cannot be dominating, terrorizing the globe and not be militant. Root of the word seems to be connected to military in some sense. So that's just my view. In fact, I'm of the opinion, if Gus is militant for just pointing out truth, we need a whole nother word to describe what racist man and racist woman are up to. And also, my other counter racist suggestion would be, anytime that sort of thing happens, to just stick with truth. That is the number one priority, in my view, when it comes to you say something or people give their views on racism and other people respond to what you said. Either they agree, they disagree, or whatever it is what was said true? That's the beginning of the analysis. You can add anything else you want to that. Is it true? How do I feel about it? What else do I think about it? But is what was said true? And I'll maintain what I said. I don't think any of this. I think racists, individuals classified as white, they are deliberately abusing black people. This takes a variety of different forms, but they generally just do a lot of the same things, which is terrorizing, stomping on, killing black people, especially non-white people, on the whole. That's what they do. I've seen no evidence that they're going to discontinue that practice. We have any folks who dialed in with a hand up. If you have commentary you'd like to share, if you had a question that you thought of that you wanted to ask Dr. Grubbs, or if you just had commentary on what you heard during the broadcast, feel free, folks who dialed in. Oh, man, I think I used since I used the Q session, I don't have the hands up anymore. So if you have commentary you would like to share, you will probably have to press *61 again. And then I'll see your hand and we can get you on the line if you have thoughts you would like to share based on what you heard from Dr. Grubbs. The caller at 5771. Did you have commentary you wanted to share?
Yes. I am in the Chicagoland area, and unfortunately I have an event to go to with my daughter. I wish I could go. I was the one that was the kidney donor to my aunt. And yeah, I asked that question because, you know, I thought it was weird. And what was interesting was I had two sessions, two psychological evaluation sessions that I had to go to before I donated my kidney to my aunt. So it's like, that was pretty weird. And like I said, you know, talking to other donors, you know, their psychological evaluations were just, you know, maybe at the most an hour, and that was basically it. So that was pretty interesting. She mentioned that the case in Atlanta where she said that the black woman was having a hard time donating her kidney. So yeah, that was all.
I'm glad you were able to call in and ask her that. And that's what I mean. I'm glad. And she responded with, that was great information that she responded, where it seems like this could be the pattern that, hey, even if you are a black person and say, hey, I'm going to donate my kidney to save my aunt. No, you're not. I think there might be some psychological issues. Matter of fact, I think we need to see. I mean, they got a variety of ways that they can practice racism, white supremacy. That's what I mean. Like, I think it's important to just speak about that honestly. If we think this is happening deliberately, or if we think, you know, whatever else you think it is, other than this is deliberate white supremacy. But yeah, I'm so glad you called in. And that's maximum black self-respect, to donate a kidney to save your aunt. That is spectacular, sir. Did other folks who dialed in, I think Thomas in New York, did you have commentary? That was also great. But the person who asked the question about if you can leave your organs to specifically to, I think that was you. Wasn't that you, Thomas?
Yes, it was. Yeah, if you could leave them specifically to black people. Yeah, I think that would be if we can do that, I think you would see a lot more black people maybe donating their organs. I really think psychologically deep down, black people do know that white people are extremely violent and racist. And that's a huge part why we don't want these people to get our organs. And I just think that if we can put that down, like, hey, we would like this organ to be left to another black person, that would definitely help us out. It will also expose their system, because as that clip in Hidden Colors just played, I contest the same thing. I think it was Dr. Umar who was hinting on it's an upkeep in violence in black areas worldwide. Why? You know, they can stop that. Living in New York is proof in the pudding. Whereas you can have over 1,000 murders 1 year, and then we're down to 300 murders now. Why? Because the police started solving them. You know, you can't get away with it. So I just think that's a huge thing that we can do, and it will expose them for needing our organs, because I personally believe that we get their organs and they get our organs. And usually black people who get organs, not from family members, that organ fails on them 5, 6, 7 years later, I believe, because they have the white organs. And a lot of white people I see, they live with their organs for 20, 30, 40 years. I was going to ask about nanotechnology. I wasn't sure if she's was familiar with that, but I've been doing a lot of research on it, on technology in general. I remember once, Gus, you said you were going to have a technology show. I would love for that to happen, because I have some information all about racism, racist technology. I mean, you'll be appalled. I just think that the nanotechnologies that I've been reading about are like little particles, that little algorithms, little artificial intelligence that they could inject inside of people, and it will go to specific organs, and the algorithms will fix the problems within the organs, or at the very least be able to detect problems 10, 20, 30 years before they occur, just based off of the movement of the blood and the different organs, how they're responding. It's just these little nanoparticles will be able to tell a doctor immediately, oh man, their kidneys are going to fail in 35 years. If they go at this rate, you might be able to change your diet way before any of these things happen, or change your lifestyle or whatever else. But I didn't think, after listening to her for a while, I didn't think she had too much knowledge on that one particular area. And I'm your mama. Thank you.
Appreciate that, Thomas in New York. Dr. Phil Valentine, Cal's guest as well. I would be curious. I know myself, because that was brought up at the talk. Some of the whites that were there, racists, at the Seattle talk, they spoke to me afterwards. I wish I had continued recording. I just was not prepared for, you know, things to continue. Anyway, they came up and they were like, yeah, what do you think can be done about, you know, people being suspicious and not wanting to be organ donors? And I said, ask the question, do you think black people should be suspicious? So, oh, yeah, absolutely. Husband and all that. But yeah, I would not. I think she said that about the driver's license. I would not. I think Dr. Umar's recommendation was to put it in your will so you can write all that up in advance. You pass that you want to leave your organs to, you know, specific family members or whatever it is, if someone needs them, or if you need to have them preserved, that sort of thing for other family members. But yeah, I would not be into it. And I think even our black mom in Detroit, she spoke before. It might have been during medical apartheid. We were talking about organs, and she said that she got contacted, and I think it was randomly, where they said, hey, would you like to donate organs? And she was, you know, trying to ask questions about how this even happened and who's going to get the organ. And I think the protocol is that you cannot know about the person that's getting your organ. They try, and the person that's getting your organ, they're not supposed to know who they're getting the organ from, right? Unless it's a family member or something. And that's supposed to try to cut down on racism, so they say. But I remember that. And I even said that I would be suspicious about, because you don't even, she said, if I recall correctly, she said she didn't even remember signing up for this or enrolling in some sort of program where she would be a potential organ donor. So yeah, I would exercise maximum suspicion about all of that, and look into, if you want to donate, look into ways that you can specify to your family members, friends, other black people specifically, but it would not be some sort of general thing, just in my view. White's history is too deadly, and that's putting it mildly. Other folks have commentary or questions that they wanted to contribute.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Roz.
Hey, greetings to you guys, to Thomas in New York, Red, and to all the other callers and listeners. I didn't get to ask a question, but I just thought about it. As Dr. Grubb was discussing the similarity within of the human genome, it just brought me to a thought, because I work in the medical field, and there are inherent differences between black people and all other non-white people. And that was through the mapping of the human genome. They found that everyone who is not of African descent on the planet basically have both Neanderthal and another hominid called Denisovian genetics, and that these genetics actually cause specific illnesses that pertain to those people who are not of African descent, because African people globally have the most diverse genome, since we were not direct descendants of the mitochondrial Adam and Eve that left Africa to populate the rest of the world. So I found that interesting. The other thing was, ultimately, when you get to, in reference to what Thomas in New York was saying in regards to the nanotechnology, I thought that was brilliant, because I actually do a book study club with Jerry, and we're reading a book called The Fantastic Voyage, Live Long Enough to Live Forever, written by Ray Kurzweil and Dr. Terry Grossman. And these are two white authors who specifically deal with different health measures that white people can take to extend their lives in order to facilitate them living long enough while science catches up with nanotechnology. And in that text, they specifically talk of replacing the human blood cells with nanotech cells that do exactly what Thomas said, repairing genetic issues before they arise, being able to correct diseases on the genetic level by using these different nanobots and artificial intelligence. So what he's talking about is phenomenally true, and that book, I think, is one of the best texts written on the subject in regards to what they're doing with nanotechnology specifically to extend the life of white people, because that's what that book is for. It's chock full of great information that black people don't normally get access to, which is why we decided to read that book, and the fact that it deals with nanotechnology and the technocracy. But specifically what Thomas brought up is all delineated in minuscule detail, scientific, genetic, you name it, they have it in there, and it's mind-blowing. The other thing that you brought up that I actually learned from Vanilla Randall and Dr. Vanilla Randall and Dorothy Roberts and even Dr. Vanessa Gruffs about involving someone else who is close to you that is healthy when you're going for medical services to protect yourself from being mistreated. And also just the whole idea of holding information back from Black people. I just have to give you a Black self-respect brief story dealing with medicine. My neighbor is elderly. She's actually a very close friend of my father-in-law, and she's a little older than him. And her family's been having trouble getting her to cooperate with facilitating a power of attorney just due to her own apprehensions to doing so. And the medical system keeps diagnosing her as mentally healthy enough to make decisions for herself, even though she's making detrimental decisions for herself in regards to not allowing one of her children to become her power of attorney. And they were trying to get her to the doctor because she hadn't been there for a long time, which was something we experienced with my father-in-law. And my wife and I were able to inform her children. She has about three children. Three children that are living. One passed away, one son, two daughters. But we were able to let them know about a visiting doctor service in the state of New Jersey, which we were trying to facilitate for 2 years. My father-in-law ended up deteriorating due to our lack of access to getting him to a doctor because no one ever told us about this. So they kind of facilitated his death by omission of this information. We happened upon it accidentally, just calling a place at random, and the woman told us about it. And instead of that family going through the same stuff that we went through, we were able to tell them off the bat, yes, in New Jersey, they had this doctor. We gave them the name of the doctor we used because he was really great with the work he did with my father-in-law. And they were so thankful because they were going through the same situation we were going through. So, again, just the concept of learning something new about the way things work, possibly in your state, in your area, and then just being able to put that information out there, whether it's on a show like this or even if you have a direct relationship or a direct conversation with another Black person who may not be aware of medical services because they keep this stuff from us because they want us to die. And a big portion of that is harvesting our organs. So I just wanted to say that. Thank you so much. Great show. And I'll mute my line.
Right on.
Yep. Can I be hurt?
Yes, ma'am.
I'm sorry. Go ahead if you had something to say.
Proceed, Red.
I did appreciate Dr. Grubb's commentary about her hair, about her physical appearance, because I feel like I'm going through that now. I'm in my 20s, and the whole feeling about my hair is definitely the same. I thought it was interesting how, like, you know, some other people have said, you know, you really don't know where these organs are coming from and this, that, and the other. But here in Ohio, because I remember not that long ago seeing some commercials just encouraging people to donate. And the reason why I remember the commercial was because they did have some Black people in the commercial. And in the commercial, it's called the program is called Donate Life Ohio. And they have people in the commercials holding up pictures of family members or people who they've gotten organs from. And I'm thinking that kind of seems weird. Some people are saying that you don't know who you're getting the organs from or giving the organs to. And I think one of the racist tactics within this whole program and in the commercial and on the website is called DonateOhio.org. Is that they have this Black male, his name is Calvin. He suffered a brain aneurysm that the doctors couldn't save him. And so his family was kind of up in the air about whether to donate his organs or not. And they thought it was against their religion. We do have quite a few Jehovah's Witnesses here, which is against their religion too. Because I have Jehovah Witnesses in my family, against their religion, to get like blood transfusion, organs, given away, what have you. But in this particular instance, they had the pastor or the minister of this person's church speak to the family and say, oh, no, it's not against the religion. So I thought that that was definitely interesting. And they do have that, like I said, it's listed on the website. So I think that that's definitely another way for whites to make us feel more comfortable with giving away our organs to help them with their lives. So that's all I wanted. Oh, The one other thing I did want to ask, and I'm glad, and I'm I didn't get to ask, was it seems like I remember seeing a show where there was an older white man. He was in the process of getting an organ, and I couldn't understand like why older people. I guess I had this misconception about if you were older, maybe that would put you closer to the bottom of the list over someone that was younger. And so that was, I guess, something that I was maybe wanting to ask, what I thought maybe age would play a role in how far up or down the list you are. That's all I had to ask. Thank you for listening.
For sure, Red. I just want to get in. I can do a full and dignified disclosure. The Dr. Grubbs publicist did not send me a copy of the book, so I did not get to read it in its entirety. I was able to read some of it in the store and online, but not the book in its totality, which is my preference. I generally take pride in reading the whole text so that I can, you know, pick out things that I want to touch on. But I'm under the impression that that is discussed in the book, because she talks about that. She talked about that when she gave her talk here in Seattle. And she talked about that in the article, that there was a white woman who was significantly older than her husband, Robert, who I think could have been no more than like 30, maybe. He was in, I guess, waiting, right, for a kidney. This white woman was significantly older. I think she was in like her 50s or 60s. And that was supposed to, you know, it is supposed to be weighted where people that are younger, because they can live longer, as opposed to you giving a kidney to somebody who's only going to live for a year and then die. That is, unless I have been misinformed, that is supposed to be a part of. In fact, we have someone who donated a kidney. Maybe they can set up, they can speak up and let me know if I'm speaking in error. But she was saying how he was looking at this like, man, this white chick is like way older, like 30 years older than I am. How is she getting a kidney before me when I'm young, I'm healthy, I have a job? Like, what is going on? Like, that was a part of the, I think racism is afoot here. But, you know, if I'm in error, folks can let me know. But I think that is, you're exactly correct, Red.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to the callers and listeners. Jay out of New York. Been a while, transferred plantation, so trying to get situated and kind of back on my feet so I can kind of get back on the show. I missed a little bit of the earlier part of the program, so I wasn't able to ask a question. But I had a college friend of mine, non-white black male, who actually had been on a list for a kidney transplant since we were in school, since we were in college. He had finally gotten a transplant probably in his late 20s. The transplant actually, after he got it, it didn't take. So after 4 years, he was back on the list. Recently, his wife actually gave him one of her kidneys, and he's doing better. One of the things that he mentioned during his process was his plantation, because the process involves a lot of trips to the hospital, especially if now your spouse is involved, so you have to go together. So they had to take a lot of days off, which started tapping into their family medical leave. And then after the surgery, his plantation was not really accommodating to the recovery, and he started running out of FMLA days. And of course, the surgeries are extremely costly, and with the way that the system is set up now, a lot of out-of-pocket costs. So one of the things that he said was really traumatizing for him is feeling that he was going to lose his job while going through the whole procedure. And of course, his spouse was also going through the same thing. So here they are taking time out of work, in and out of the hospital, and you know, the terroristic threat of him losing his job because they weren't really supportive of him. I'm pretty sure if, you know, one of their white dogs were going through a surgery, they would have been able to take tons and tons of days off without even having to jump into FMLA. But he was going through that, and he, you know, had a lot of stress throughout the whole process, and that started causing other ailments in his recovery. But thankfully, he was able to kind of fully recover. His wife also fully recovered. I did want to ask Dr. Grubb in reference to her experience. I know she's kind of at a higher level in terms of the position she held on the plantation, but if there was any situations where she dealt with that same type of terroristic activity. But good program. My aunt just came back from Haiti, just to kind of mention that as I heard that in a clip. And one of the things she mentioned is the amount of individuals that had family members that were unfortunately taken by this man-made tragedy. And a number of the folks just, there was nothing. I mean, after loved ones were kind of just perished, nothing. There was nobody to call, nobody to find out information from. And it's just very interesting that you go on these heavily melanated, within these heavily melanated areas of the world where these things happen. And just like I talk about with the Ohio thing and, you know, when the whites are having problems, their bodies pile up. But when we have issues, you never hear about where all these bodies are going. And I look at the same thing within Haiti and different areas. Just really interesting. And you know, the parallels kind of speak for themselves. But just wanted to just kind of chime in, and great show thus far. Thanks.
Appreciate that. Any other folks have commentary they wanted to share? I heard both of you.
Go ahead, Tom.
Oh, sure, man. I'll real quick, because this train's about to take off, and I'm going to lose the signal. My mother had a coworker who she taught with for over 30 years. She's a school teacher. And this lady recently went to the doctor and had a mammogram done, and they found a lump. And they checked the lump, and they saw that it was cancerous. And prior to her going to get this mammogram done, she'd been going to a back specialist because she was having back pain, which they said was arthritis. And it turned out that the day before they were going to remove the lump on her breast, the doctor called her and said, listen, we found some odd work in your blood, you know, we want to do a spinal tap and check into your spine before we do the surgery. And what they found out was that she has spinal cancer. And this lady's been going to a specialist. So she ends up at the hospital I work at. And they compare her mammograms for like the last 10 years. And they find out that she has not only one cancerous lump, but she has over 10. And the doctors missed it for 10 years. So, of course, they have a lawsuit. But anyway, this lady can't walk anymore. I mean, just last week she was at a barbecue with my father, and now she's bedridden with stage 4 cancer overnight. And I just felt like you talk about medical apartheid or malpractice. This is a lady with excellent insurance, worked at the Board of Education, and this still was what she ended up getting. Also, with the organ donors, they have a whole wall at the hospital filled with people. It hasn't been updated in probably about 2 or 3 years, but with the pictures of people who've been killed in art fire accidents or murders and donated their organs, and you could literally count on your two hands the white people. It's mostly all black people, Filipinos, Indians, but there is not a lot of white people on that wall. So I just don't get that we're not the ones giving the organs. And I'll mute my line. Thank you. Oh, one more thing. Another co-worker of my mother at another medical apartheid school calls my mother up because her nephew, this is my mother's very best friend, also a school teacher. She's a principal. Her nephew has had a psychotic issue. He had pulled out a knife on his landlord. His wife called the, you know, police because he hadn't been taking his medication. Either way, this is something that had happened before the police came. They brought him to the hospital I work at. So she calls my mother while I'm at my mother's house. You know, she's telling my mother that her sister's saying they have him in a dungeon. So I said, oh, they put him in DCOM. So, I mean, like, I'm explaining how this works. I mean, they don't, I mean, the level of stuff they do to people with psychotic issues inside the hospital, they have a room that's built. It's actually outside the hospital, but they made, like, a little wooden or plastic shed around it. And this is where they do the decon for people who come in with maybe they're erratic, yelling at the police and stuff like that. They put them in there. So if it's in the winter, you're freezing to death. If it's in the summer, you're burning to death. And, you know, it's torture. It's a torture chamber. And the only thing in there is a hose to hose the person down. And they strip you naked and they pour the water on you. So I'm just saying, like, this is the type of stuff that's happening in the hospital in America that most people don't have any idea of.
Medical apartheid, indeed. The other male caller who chimed in simultaneously, thank you for yielding the floor.
Yes, from the little I know about the medical field, I get from my wife and family members who work in the medical field. You know, one of the things that I learned a couple of years ago was about trauma centers. Now, from my understanding, and if somebody can correct me if I'm wrong, that trauma centers are supposed to treat gunshot victims. Now, it's no secret in Chicago that most of the gunshot victims here in Chicago are on the south side. However, they're, out of all the hospitals on the south side of Chicago, only one hospital has a trauma center. Now, one of the theories that we kind of talk about here is when these victims, mostly non-white black, you know, men who are shot, the nearest hospital is Northwest Memorial, which is on the south side of downtown Chicago, which is typically about a good 25 minutes away from most of the neighborhoods that experience these violence in Chicago. You know, talking about Chatham and Inglewood and all these other neighborhoods. And during that time, if you're taking somebody all the way there, most of the time they don't make it. So sometimes we kind of feel that they're probably removing their organs at that moment when they expire. So, you know, and it just makes no sense. I mean, you know, typical racism, a lot of the victims on one side of the city, and you have one trauma center, you have one hospital with a trauma center. Now, they're finally getting a trauma center in University of Chicago, which is in the Woodlawn area, but that won't be till next year. But, yeah, it's, you know, that right there, you know, racism in effect, and probably one of the reasons, one of the big reasons why a lot of gunshot victims here in Chicago don't survive, because we only have one hospital with a trauma center on the south side. So that's all I want to add.
I remember when the Obama Library was awarded to Chicago, there were a number of black Chicago residents who said, you know, forget a presidential library. We need a trauma center. Like, that's a real world, tangible problem that we are experiencing that is a bigger priority than a presidential library. I wrote about that. Other folks, do we have anybody else who had commentary they wanted to make sure they got in?
Yes, Gus, could I say one more thing?
Sure.
All right, thank you. Yes, I wanted to just speak about another inherent difference between white people and other non-white people, because this particular illness specifically affects white people. And essentially it has to do with bringing a child to term as far as pregnancy is concerned. Working in the medical field, there's a drug called Rogam, and it's spelled R-H-O-G-A-M. This drug is provided to white women who have what's known as the rhesus monkey factor. It's a rhesus factor, but it comes from the rhesus monkey. And essentially, white people have monkey DNA, and to be what they call Rh negative means that you actually carry DNA from this particular monkey species. When you're Rh positive, which black people and other non-white people are Rh positive, you do not have the rhesus monkey factor as it's known. What it does is basically, if the white female she herself is Rh negative, which means she has that genetic factor. Her offspring will be Rh positive, and her body treats her fetus as an invading vector or disease and tries to abort. And in order for her body not to reject her own fetus, she has to take Rogam. And that allows her to carry a child to term. Without Rogam, she will never be able to have a child because everyone would die. Mind you, they said about 25 to 40% of white people, white women, carry this illness. This is not a disease that's inherent in black people, but they found it in the United States specifically when I did my research. 5 to 7% of black females have the same disease. These people are descendants of rape victims by the system of white supremacy. So that white genetic infusion has allowed some of our women to develop the same disease characteristics from the process of being raped and mistreated intergenerationally. So that is another inherent difference between white people and non-white people, and it's on a genetic DNA level. That's another thing I wanted to just throw out there for people to think about, because this is something I've personally come across numerous times dealing with medical billing, where I've had countless white women have me explain bills to them, processing of their insurance claims surrounding Rogam and its use. And when I started to research it, it just gave me further insight into the inherent genetic recessive rogue non-human DNA that they carry. And by them raping people, they're spreading this stuff to us in ways that are appearing like this. So thank you. I'll mute my line.
Appreciate that, Roz. Wanted to make sure I got in. Certainly other folks will have time, but just wanted to make sure I really emphasize, because I did not think, I never considered myself to be someone who was really knowledgeable about the medical industry, and I still don't. But man, we have covered a lot of subject matter related to medical racism over the almost 9 years that we've been on the program. And I mean, all the way back from some of the first programs, Dr. Nancy, and I mean, from a variety of different perspectives, Dr. Nancy Krieger, she's at the Harvard Medical Program, and she talked about the research that she does related to racism and stress healthcare. As I mentioned, Dorothy Roberts, phenomenal work that she's had on the program. Stephen Bezruchka, he's a white professor at the University of Washington's medical program. And he, same thing, talks about racism's impact on the health of black people. I mean, we've had tons of folks on the program. We even had a medical doctor, an Indian medical doctor on the program. And he talked about how non-white doctors also mistreat black patients. Talked about that extensively on the program. He was live from India, no less, but extensively covered on the program. Is tons and tons of programs that we've covered this material. I'd say that's definitely an area that you should pay a lot of attention to. Health is important to everybody. Racists do a lot of damage in this particular area. We have other folks who had a question or comment there, commentary that they wanted to add.
Yeah.
Hello. Can I make a comment about the genetics?
Yes, ma'am.
Yep. So I asked a question to Dr. Grubbs about whether she felt there were fundamental differences from a genetic point of view between whites and non-whites. And the response is what we've been trained to give, which is, you know, 9% of the genome. It's similar. We can't find any explanation for the difference, so there must not be any. But to me, from a logical point of view, stepping aside from that rhetoric, it's just not logical. You can't end up with a phenotypic person who looks like a non-white person, a black person, and there be no genetic programming for that difference. It's as if you have two apple seeds, they look the same. You plant them both on the ground, you get a difference. You get one apple tree that's Fuji apples, you get another apple tree that's Rome apples. Those are two different apples. The seeds you may not be able to tell the difference in the seed by looking at it with the technology you have, but the outcome is a phenotypic difference. So I think maybe one of the biggest lies out there is that there is no genetic difference. And listening to some of the commentary from some of the other callers, I think the genetic differences between whites and non-whites is such that non-white people are more genetically fit for life on this planet. It's just logical to me. If you look at the numbers of people, obviously non-white people are the majority. And I wanted to ask Dr. Grubbs a follow-up question
because given the medical industrial complex, the way they develop medications, vaccines, and so forth, it's all based on white people. So if there are actually differences that exist between non-white and white people, which I believe there are, they would have to change the way they do medical research. Right now, you have the majority of the people involved in the research are white people. They use albino mice. They use albino hamsters. So, of course, the outcome of any products from such a system are going to favor that type of genetic profile. So I wanted to sort of bring that out and try to ask her some questions, but I know from the medical training that we have, we're taught there are no differences, nothing to see here. Everyone's the same. Carry on. Just gather the information about race and then treat everyone the same as far as the medications and vaccines and so forth. And I think it's a huge area where I'm trying to learn more and understand, because I think it's just a travesty. So those are my comments.
Appreciate that. Was there a male caller who spoke up simultaneously?
Yeah, it was me. I had a question. I sort of got cut off a little bit during the commercial break, and I was, I guess maybe for even the callers that live in like the New York, New Jersey area, I remember maybe it's a few years ago when I think they arrested some so-called Jewish people. I guess they were members of some synagogue, and they had a ring of some sort of where they were got caught doing harvesting and whatnot. I don't know if people followed up with that. I just remembered it not right now. The story sort of died. I don't know if people have followed that and if they had any news.
Sounds vaguely familiar, but there are a lot of these different cases of harvesting rings being broken, even explicitly with black people, but it sounds vaguely familiar. I'll check online and see if I can find any follow-up information. Do we have other folks who had commentary? Anybody had a hand up more recently?
Greetings. Hello. Can I be heard?
I think, yes. Go ahead, Emmy.
I'll be really quick with the female doctor that just spoke. I was kind of thinking the same thing when I heard your question, and then when you spoke again, that's kind of what I wanted to say, that I feel like that whole genome project is just a bunch of rhetoric. I'm sure that there is considerable scientific basis to it and rationale for it, but I don't think that just because you can map the human genome or the various sequences that nucleotides can make to form DNA, that means that we're all the same. Even we all have adenine, thiocine, guanine, and cytosine or whatever, but that doesn't mean that it's all the same just because the same amino acids form proteins and so forth. So I think that that's just like a very comfortable place to be. One thing I think that's, I wanted to ask her a question just about her becoming a doctor. I think that one of the things, there's these higher professions, so-called, they require so much investment of time, besides money, but so much investment of time. And I think that when young people are pushed to like make that choice early, sometimes they're very confused making that choice, and they do it for a bunch of different reasons, you know. But when you do that, I think that's what people are talking about. Well, Dr. Wilson, she would say, like, the more education they get, the dumber they get. Her grandma said it to her someday or something like that. That when you're that young and you just kind of go all the way through and you don't have life experiences and you don't have accurate information, then I think what you're able to really do and see and how you're able to come at things, you're really shaped by that training. So I wanted to ask her, but then I kind of was just like, it really doesn't even matter if, like, how she felt about age and selecting these higher professions like medicine and stuff. Just because when you are younger and someone tells you racism is this, or someone tells you that there's this human genome and so there's no evidence that there's any difference, that completely deludes logic. I think the same thing. If you can see a difference, there must be some difference. Now, we can't deny that difference. It doesn't mean that someone has to be better or higher evolved than the other, which is like the way that it's taken when we talk about difference. But the little bit that I do know, non-white people have not really had that issue where we see difference and view hierarchy. Traditionally or culturally, maybe in antiquity, I don't know. I don't think that that's how we view things. So to state like, yeah, we were able to match the human genome and yeah, we all have these certain things, but there is some difference, even like little bit, like how medications, the way that the doctor was talking about, I've heard of that too. Not all medications work well for all people. And if that's the case, then there must be some difference. That's just logical. And so I kind of just gave up on the question just like at that point, because I was like, I could think about it myself. But I do think she's very informed and I enjoyed listening to her. She has kind of like a sass about her. So that was fun. It'd be great if she could come back and we could spend more time talking about stuff. And I'm sure her book is full of lots of information. But those couple of things I think are very dangerous, just when the mind is shaped really young and hasn't really been like, you really don't know how to critically think and just say like, and choose your logic versus what the institution and academia and training is putting in your face. But that was it. So I thank you all for listening. Y'all have a good night.
Yes, ma'am. Was there another female caller who spoke up simultaneously? Good to hear from Emmy.
Hello.
Yes, ma'am.
For anyone that would like to refuse organ donation, there's an actual medical opt-out card that one can get documented. And if you go to a particular website, it has a template, because apparently just to put the no organ decline on your DMV card is not enough. And more than likely it wouldn't be honored at a hospital or someone would, you know, get hurt. So can I share the website, Seth?
Oh, sure.
So the website is cart.lifeguardianfoundation.org. And you can, for as little as $2, you can buy the opt-out card template, and it also has further instructions on getting a, you know, yeah. So that's all I wanted to share. And I appreciate it, Roz's insight. Thank you.
Right on. Context of white supremacy. Other folks have commentary they wanted to make sure that they got in.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
This is Red again. I just had a question. You briefly spoke about the episode where you spoke to the Indian doctor who also said that Indian doctors, they are discriminative or against non-whites. What was the name of the episode, or maybe do you have like the year?
That was from 2012. And let's see, I think I could give you the date. If you give me maybe 40 seconds or so, I could probably give you the name and month and everything.
Let's see. All right, thank you.
For sure. It should be in the iTunes feed. If it's not, I will add it today. But I'm pretty sure it was from 2012. And woof. Lots of programs over the years, man. Okay. 2012. I think it was in the spring of 2012, and it stands out as memorable because of the time difference. It was so substantial that I had to, I think it was like 1 o'clock in the morning or something bizarre, just because it was such a substantial time difference. But yeah, that's why it stands out as being especially memorable. Okay. 2012. Let's see. Might have went too far. Might take me a little too long to pull it up. I think I'm going in the wrong direction on my file. Once I lock it down, I will make sure to share. While I'm taking a second to locate, I guess I could have the wrong year too, but while I'm taking a moment to locate again, Friends Went On is Friday for folks who are looking.
Sorry guys, it's May 6th. The reason why I know is because I listened to it about a week ago, and I think the person is a Dr. Siraj. So if you, I was on the YouTube, so his name is Dr. Siraj. It's S-A-W-R-A-J, and his last name is Singh, S-I-N-G-H, and it is the 6th of May, 2012.
Grand. Thank you for the help. Woof. Lots to dig through. I found it finally while the caller located it, but there you go. And he did have great information in addition to talking about how non-white doctors also abuse, and it was abuse black people specifically, or black patients specifically. He did have a lot of other great information during the program. It was cool to have him on. It was worth it to be up at that, to be broadcasting at that kooky hour, May 6th, 2012. But yeah, he had great info. Might be worth checking out. Similar subject matter. Global perspective, same problem.
Hey, all right, Dad? Thank you. It looks... I'm sorry. I just want to let you know, I was just going through iTunes because I do have an iPhone. It doesn't look like it's on there, but I'll go on YouTube. And thank you for the other caller. I did write down the information. Thank you. That's all I wanted to add.
Mm-hmm. Roz, was that you?
Yes, yes. I just wanted to touch base on something that a previous caller had brought up about the organ harvesting ring in New Jersey. There's an article on justiceforpoland.com, and the title is Israel is the Organ Harvesting and Human Trafficking Global Ringleader with Complicit Help from the U.S. and Turkey. And they have a link to another site where they got the information from, and it's quite detailed. But I just wanted to read two brief sections out of it just to give people an understanding of what's happening. So it says here, fact. Syrian Medical Forensics Department says 18,000-plus Syrians have had organs removed during the war thus far, plus 386,000 estimated dead Syrians. And then the other section has to do specifically with New Jersey and New York, and I just found it quite fascinating what they had here about that. I'm just trying to pull it up real quick. I think I went too far. Where's New Jersey, New York? New Jersey, New York. Oh, it says here, there we go. I'm sorry. Give me 1 second. I got past it a second ago. Okay. So it says, Israel number one in organ harvesting, leading role in the international crime syndicate. Quote, organized through a local business corporation in conjunction with leading transplant surgeons operating out of a major medical center not far from Tel Aviv, connected to transplant surgeons in Turkey, Russia, Moldova, Estonia, Georgia, Romania, Brazil, and New York City. Hundreds of Israelis have created a production line that starts in the villages of Moldova where men are walking around with one kidney, unquote. And they also talk about the way that they treat other human beings as far as this organ harvesting. They equate it to finning, shark finning, and hunting elephants for tusks, where they just basically take the animal's body parts and leave them to bleed to death. They said this is the same sort of treatment that the human beings that they're harvesting these organs from are going through, where they just, you know, they'll take the organs, leave them to die, and it doesn't matter as long as they get the organs that matter so they can sell them. And in one section they said here, in 2009, Israeli rabbi in New York City paid donors in Israel $10,000 for a kidney and sold them for $120,000 each. And this is one of the main reasons that's facilitating the human trafficking and organ trafficking. So I just wanted to just put that out there. And it's justiceforpoland.com is the website. The title, again, is Israel, number one in child trafficking and number one in organ trafficking. All right. Thank you. I'll mute my line.
Context of white supremacy. Other folks have commentary. Dr. Grubbs, I guess, hour plus. Visit with us, any other commentary on what she had to share or similar subject matter? Everybody satisfied? Make sure I didn't miss any hands on the switchboard. I checked Narcan. I know Red in Ohio has been researching the opioid epidemic and how that's unfolding. We talked about Narcan. That's Amphastar Pharmaceuticals, the company that manufactures Narcan. They have dropped a few, I think like 20 cents. So it's down to like 17.20 per share. It was at 18, about 18.50 last week. If people are looking for investment opportunities, we talked about that before. It has dropped a little bit. So if you want to be cautious or thinking about that at all. Everybody satisfied? Everyone got their comments in or questions?
Guess, may I say something on that? I actually, this is Red again. I was continuing my research. There was a article in another Ohio newspaper, and it was talking about how Chicago is now giving departing inmates the overdose reverse drug. So still same Narcan. Just wanted to add that, and I'll share some more on Saturday. Thank you.
Wow. That's what I was saying. This might be one of those to purchase. Like, it might be a good thing if it's dropping, gives you an opportunity to purchase it lower and get more shares. One to research and think about if we think this opioid problem is going to continue, and they'll be looking to make sure that whites have all the proper medications so that they can continue to dope up and exist and live forever. Fantastic voyage. I assume everyone is satisfied. We should be here at minimum on Thursday, Workplace Racism. And then we'll be back on Friday for France Fanon, Wretched of the Earth, Session 2. But it's the actual beginning of Fanon's writing, all 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. If you get confused, if you cannot find something in the archives, even Gus, sometimes it can take a while to dig and find things in 9 years of programming. Just drop me an email and we will find it. I'm going to add the Dr. Singh broadcast to the iTunes feed as soon as the broadcast completes. So, well, I guess I'll do this program first and then I'll do Dr. Singh. So it'll be both uploaded this evening. To iTunes, Black Talk Radio Network, SoundCloud, lots of places, YouTube, lots of places that you can get Cal's archives. If you have problems finding something, locating a program, just let me know and I'll try to help expeditiously. Invest if you think the program is constructive, racism-notes.blogspot.com, racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you hit the blog, PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you're not into PayPal, drop us an email. We'll get you a physical mailing address. Huge thanks to all the folks who have supported, invested almost 9 years. I hope it has been constructive. And again, you can also hit the wish list at Amazon.com under Gus T. Renegade. Thanks so much for everyone who has kept us on the air. And black self-respect to Dr. Vanessa Grubbs. Again, you don't have to agree. I do not agree with anybody, like 100%. There's no non-white person where I have complete agreement with their views, but black self-respect, donating a kidney to save her black husband. She's a black mom, black doctor, and has written about racism, white supremacy. Kudos. But I do think it's important to make sure that we are speaking accurately and that we are not giving a cushion or giving the impression that this is anything other than direct, deliberate, intentional, and infinite white terrorism, deliberate abuse and warfare against black people, especially. That's the way that we should be couching these conversations to make sure that there's no confusion or pussyfooting about why these things are happening and why it takes courageous, truthful dialogue about this issue. That said, thanks again for tuning into the broadcast. Hope it was a constructive investment of your time and energy. If you're in the Chicago area, check out Dr. Grubbs. Ask questions. Ask questions because she might come to your area and, you know, might not be a day or time to talk about racism. So ask some questions and she'll have some great information to share, it seems. With that, sobriety would be best. I think in terms of kidney health, man, your kidneys would love it. No alcohol. Doing your kidneys a favor. That right there. But sobriety would be best. Alcohol, cigarettes,
anything. You just talked about Narcan, anything. Sobriety would be best. There is so much evidence race soldiers and whites in general have terrorized and helped keep their foot on black people's necks with all of their poisons and narcotics. I think Dr. Welsing and many others, I think they would strongly recommend we do everything that we can to manage our health. Part of that would be staying sober so we can use our brain computers to the maximum of their ability to come up with solutions to the problem. Racist man, racist woman, racist child. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Context of White Supremacy signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.